Hello, and welcome to the Watson Weekend. We're your hosts. I'm Rick Watson.
Hi, it's Jessica Laseski. Welcome to another Friday.
Yeah, at the Watson Weekend, we are your weekly dose of retail, technology, and e-commerce. I mean, almost like a TikTok dance challenge you asked for or didn't ask for, but you got anyway.
And you cannot stop watching, right?
No, you have to keep watching us.
That's right. We may not have the moves yet. We're practicing in the mirror. We're getting better. Chair dancing is a honed in skill.
It's a thing. You've got to work on it over time. It's a thing. It's coming back.
That's right.
I thought I would mention, thank you to Miracle, who's our sponsor. Just a quick mention. They're really focused on being against traditional commerce because they think it's really code for not growing. And how do you do better than the status quo? Their retailers, over 450 retailers, are growing faster, six times faster with AI automation and a platform built for marketplace, dropship, and e-com at enterprise-grade scale across retail media as well. So time to accelerate with Miracle. Thank you again for sponsoring.
Absolutely. Yeah, well, the news does feel like it is this continuous cycle of repeat, but there are some little gems that we have picked up on and we're going to share for you today. That's right, guys. It's time for the headline hangover as always, and really appreciate Passport for bringing this to us. All right. Well, NRF woke up. Rick, I don't know if you were aware. You know, we've been talking about all the tariff discussions. It just kind of feels like they've been in like sleepy time, maybe a little too much melatonin. But they woke up and on the 9th of June produced a report that started to talk with Hackett and Associates that started to talk about what the import volume is looking like. Mm-hmm. And while we don't have data yet for May, the forecast is not looking so good as a result of the tariffs. So actually what they're forecasting for May is that we're going to see declines for the first time, 8% year over year. And a lot of this comes with the uncertainty. So a lot of confusion with retailers. Should they not? When should they buy? What's the tariffs going to look like? We are in a pause for the most part, but that doesn't really give anyone the warm and fuzzies. So what's your take here?
Yeah, I mean, I think the take is, where are the NRF at? I guess they're here. I went on their website the other day and I found, like, related to tariffs, there is a form on their website that is sort of like buried in there. You can submit them your feedback on the tariffs. I don't think they really announced the fact that this was on their website, but... So I'm sure they're just still collecting data.
Yeah, it's super helpful, right? I mean, this is the lobbying group that's like supposed to have your back and be fighting the good fight. I guess a report is interesting, but do you think they're on the Hill, like tapping on the shoulder saying, hey guys, what's up? You're killing our small businesses here, or what's your take? You think that they're just kind of letting this ride?
Yeah, it seems like between the breakup of the bromance and the big, beautiful bill that's going through conference, it seems like NRF is just sort of trying to keep their political head down and not run afoul of the administration. So as a result, they can't criticize things too much or else they'll lose their influences. But if they don't criticize enough, then they're actually not doing their retail members who are paying their dues any favors. Yeah. So what's the point of an organization that doesn't lobby for you, but is supposed to?
I think that's the question everyone would like to know. Maybe we should ask one of our mini AI assistants, which we're going to talk about later. What should you do? But this one we'll be watching very closely and see if there's any influence that actually happens or if it's just more liquid lunches.
Exactly.
TBD.
Our next story is with regards to Dollar General. They're actually seeing a big win from SKU reduction, which is not something you see. Usually you're seeing people expanding assortment. They're seeing a 6.9% decrease in inventory levels after a removal of 1,000 SKUs. They're also scaling back use of temporary warehouses. It kind of seems to me that this is sort of an ongoing effect of the agents of efficiency. retailers like traditionally, like Costco, has sort of a very tight assortment that really turns over very quickly at very low margin. Dollar General, I guess, felt like the long tail of their SKUs was not selling through fast enough. And so as a result, they had all this extra inventory space right. in stores. I can see how it makes sense. During a March earnings call, the CEO basically said that our next focus is on pack optimization, which kind of makes me wonder if I'm going to get less in my Cheetos pack when I stop by Dollar General, which I don't think they have any in New York City. So somebody will have to write
in. You're really missing out because the gems of you know, what used to be on Temu is like now probably floating into Dollar General. You know, you're going to miss out on your like small version of the Ivory soap. That's a couple of ounces less than what you would get in a normal store, but it's at least a dollar. I think that it is interesting to see, especially when, to your point, they had put more assortment in, and I'm sure it was just to fill the carts, see if they could pick up a couple extra items along the way. And I'm sure, you know, this will be a theme we'll hear across, especially because of tariffs. I'm sure there's going to have to be some bets placed on what the assortment is that you need to have versus, you know, spreading it across so many different long tail items.
Yeah. And I think other retailers have also said that they're going to use this strategy to help get through sort of the tariff times. I think Home Depot in particular said we're not raising prices, but it didn't say it was keeping the same assortment. In fact, they said they could be reducing the number of items that they sell. So that's definitely a trend we'll be continuing to watch as we go forward.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we talked about, you know, the shopping assistants are so hot right now, Zoolander style. So, you know, if your shopping assistant's your game and your Walmart, Sparky is the name. So we're calling this, you know, Sparky and Wally walk into a bar together. But I really want to know what's going to happen when Sparky and Rufus come together, which Rufus is Amazon's AI assistant. Like, who wins in that battle? More to come there. But Walmart is getting into this shopping assistant and focusing on a couple of things like item comparisons, helping customers complete the shopping journey. They talk about these are the tasks that it feels like are really ripe for a shopping assistant. It's not surprising to see them jump in here. I think if any retailer could make a shopping assistant work, it's probably Walmart. They usually are very innovative. They're on the side of leaning into technology. And because of the marketplace, they do have so much assortment to pull from that it does feel like they could help. Now, when Sparky starts to upsell and grow that cart, that's when we've hit, you know, the end game here. But what do you think, Rick? Do Sparky and Rufus, who wins in that fight?
Yeah, I mean, I find it very ironic that there is an AI assistant called Wally, and then there was a movie called Wally years ago, which was a parody of Walmart from the corporation By and Large, which seemed to have taken over the world. And now we have an AI assistant from Walmart called Wally, non-ironically. Sparky is also going to have some new capabilities that I haven't seen or heard from Rufus, including allowing you to reorder and potentially place orders on your behalf. I haven't heard Amazon talk about those things. So right now, I guess from a vision point of view, it looks like Sparky.
You know. It probably should have been Wally. I mean, Sam Altman, like what? I don't know. But
Sally, you know, maybe, we should call her.
Yeah, maybe they wanted to keep it neutral, you know? So like who is Sparky? I think Chevy Chase in National Lampoon's. and if he is not part of this commercial,
missed opportunity.
It's total missed opportunity. We'll see. We'll see what happens. Exactly. All right. You're going to bring us home with the last story.
Yeah. Bring us home. Oh, Target.
Oh, Target.
We're missing half of our executive team and we have a CEO, which probably won't be with us another 12 months. Their reputation damage seems to be continuing, especially in the very euphemistic current political climate. And their foot traffic has been down for, make sure I get this right, 16 of the last 18 weeks. I mean, Target has historically been a very sort of like DEI-focused company, and it's been celebrated with celebrating Pride Month and people from all sorts of backgrounds and walks of life. And that's part of the reason that you felt good about shopping at Target. Like, well, as soon as a company announced, like, well, I guess as soon as what happened is DEI got declared illegal. I think I read that somewhere. And Target said, oops, we're not going to do that. So not only did you already have one side of the political spectrum upset at you for previously being DEI too woke, now you have all the people who appreciated that about you also upset. And so coincidentally, since they made that announcement, foot traffic keeps falling. And how consumers feel about them, seems like confidence is going down. Consumer confidence is not bad, but there's something going on here, isn't there, Jess?
Oh yeah, it is rough o'clock if you're Target and trying to dig yourself out. I think normally people are like, oh, this too shall pass, and it is not passing. You know, it has been, like you said, a steady decline week over week. I think something else that was interesting in this survey was when people were asked, like, would you recommend Target to others if given the chance? I think a lot of people used to recommend Target all the time.
Yeah.
Where did you get this? Where do you get your clothes? Like Cat and Jack, it was such a big brand at one point. They took that international, right? Took that into Canada. So it was a 24.5% decline from January to May in people who said that they would strongly agree. There's other, you know, negative trends around like Target behaving responsibly. That fell 10.8%. Also just Target demonstrates leadership. That score fell as well. So I think that this this kind of pendulum that people really had Target on, pedestal, pendulum, same word, right? It's
We're
Friday.
There.
Sorry, guys. Are you here with me? Yeah. So this pedestal that people had Target on is for sure shredded at this point. It is interesting though, because other retailers I think have pulled back. We were talking about Walmart, earlier, you know, they've kind of done the same thing, but it's not seemed to have the same impact. And maybe that's just to your point, a testament of like the diversity of their customer base. And they had not isolated or alienated them. But it's going to be rough, I think, for Target to dig out of this. And who's benefiting? It's Costco. Costco's traffic has actually been up. And they've not had the same issues. And so I do think that they've seen membership sales go up. So they're probably thanking their friends down in Minneapolis for the goodness.
Correct. And so, yeah, we're going to keep tracking Target. I'm not seeing an easy resolution here. I think they're just going to have a leadership reset. There's going to be a mea culpa at some point. There's going to have to be a reset in strategy. And so the only question is when. Is it going to be in the next 3 months or is it going to be the next year? We will go there. But thank you again. This has been your Headline Hangover. We appreciate our sponsors, Passport. We had a great event at The Lead with Passport where I don't know if you've seen the clips. I put on a wig.
I did. And some bling. You had a lot of
bling. So thank you again, Passport, for playing along with us.
Hey, is that jacket like hanging in your closet? Do you plan on wearing this again? Are we going to see it on the show? Inquiring minds want to know.
No, yes, and yes.
I feel a bet that we're going to have to make coming on. You know, I had to wrap. I'm going to make you wear this jacket and wig at some point. It's going to happen.
Yeah, but as we move along, I have one question for you, Jess.
Okay, lay it on me.
Where are leaders at?
Where are leaders? I said, any leaders in the house? I think we are craving leadership now more than ever. In uncertain times, leaders can make or break organizations. And you're craving that like stability, the steadiness, the people have to be able to navigate through uncertainty. Communication is critical. How you organize cross-functional teams, all of these are responsibilities of a leader. And on top of that, you just want to know, can you trust them at the end of the day? And so we are so excited to bring this episode to you. It's a rerun, but not in the full sense. We did a couple of clips of this show. And so, Rick, I'll let you introduce what we're going to walk our guests through the rest of the day.
Yeah, our episode is based on an interview we did a couple months ago with Sid Jatia, who's the global VP and head of commerce and services at General Motors. So it's a very interesting, it's not necessarily just focused on cars, although obviously that's an interesting topic. But if you think about sort of the full scope of what GM does, including OnStar, and the idea is such a large corporation, getting teams aligned around common goals is, mm-hmm. I think, difficult for everyone. And so ultimately what we thought was, we weren't doing the previous interview justice. We're going to run the whole thing from end to end. And so we hope you will appreciate that. And so stick with us.
Yeah, there's so many good nuggets here, and hopefully you guys will enjoy it. But I know I sure did. I was like taking lots of notes. So
yeah. I enjoyed the beach hair again. So
we're that's really why you guys brought it back in the beach hair don't care mode. I think that's really what's going down here.
Exactly. So here we go with Sid. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, y'all. Hello, welcome, Sid. We're so excited to have you on the show. Before we dive in, can you just give us a bit of background, or give our viewers some background about yourself and your world and role in the e-commerce landscape?
Sure. So good morning, good afternoon, and nice to see you both, Rick and Jess. Outside of this forum, I also claim that Rick is a good friend. So for whatever that's worth, it's nice to be here and talk to you all. So when you talk about my world, our world is very dynamic, I would say, professionally, as we go through this liberation day. Automotive, as you guys know, is got into the whirlwind of conversations. But just personally, my background has been primarily, I would say, within the commerce space for the last 25 years and slew of different roles. But I pride myself growing up in the design industry, both in architecture as well as fine arts, early in my career. And then last sort of, I would say, 15, 17 of the 25 years has been more commercially oriented roles. So, and I always have found interest in terms of the dichotomy between design and commerce. So it's just nice, you know. I've been fortunate to have had leaders and enterprises given me opportunity to bring that stuff together. So GM, another great company, you know, and doing some really interesting things there.
That's exciting.
First of all, thank you for coming on. We're so happy to have you here, and it's been too long, my friend. We didn't catch up at this Shop Talk, but we have, I know, previously. We have a lot of, I think, interesting topics related to leadership. How do you put together teams? The role of merchandising, the buyer experience, particularly for a purchasing journey that's not simplistic and it's very configurable. How do you get the attention of consumers? I think there are a lot of interesting topics throughout your background. I know we met originally when you were at Microsoft, and now obviously following your work at GM. So I'm excited to dive in and get to some of these topics.
Yeah. Sounds good.
Well, do we want to start with leadership? Because, you know, we talked a lot about the evolving role of the modern organization and how you should really structure organizations to thrive and execute really well. And you've worked at some very large companies. You know, GM, of course, is probably a behemoth to navigate. What is something that you do to help your teams stay focused in times that are uncertain? And we're certain in a lot of unpredictability the past couple of years, regardless of your industry. So can you help us unpack that a bit and how you keep them focused and executing well?
Yeah, thanks for asking that question, Jess. I think there's a lot of great sort of strategies different leaders deploy, and you know, it sort of, it's a bit of like personal choice, because every leader can execute certain things differently and well, and certain others can't. For me, like, one thing I found really interesting and useful is kind of a high-low strategy. So the high-low strategy, which is when you get focused on starting something, it's good to do some strategy and vision setting, but don't get caught up in, like, you know, get manifesting just the super detailed vision.
Right.
Have some high-level sort of blocking, high-level sort of envelope thinking, and then focus on execution. Because what I've found with teams is that execution drives morale.
Yeah.
Vision doesn't drive morale. Execution drives morale. So how do you get them into execution mode? Let them see some dividends of the work they do. Because the best dividend is this customer actually using your product.
Right.
So if you can find these little pockets of execution, and then you extract yourself back into the highest high mode, which is like, what are we really trying to do? Did we just something execute? Was that a proxy to our vision? Is our vision really where it needs to be? So if you can keep going to this high-low mode, I found teams not only just synced up to the common thread and the goal, but also at the end of the day, we want to make sure people feel sort of rewarded for what they do and feel like, you know, there's a payoff to showing up.
And yeah, that's great.
I think it's interesting. Your role kind of intersects commerce and service together with, I think it's a little bit unusual, particularly with some of the guests that we bring on. How did you feel like you got here? First of all, like, let's start simple. How did you get here? And what do you think inspires you to sort of continue to drive your teams to the next level? And then we'll kind of dive in from there.
Yeah. So just in terms of how I got to GM, as you mentioned, Drake, you know, I previously worked at Microsoft, leading the strategy for retail at Azure. And then I was at Under Armour leading digital and commerce at, you know, during some really, I would say, amazing times at Under Armour, especially as we acquired the software business for My Fitness Pal, MapMyRun, how do those things connect between software and shirts and shoes? So it's a lot of good stuff there, but GM particularly, I've always been a brand person, and maybe blame that on my kind of design pedigree. Like, I feel like if you don't have a brand ethos, you know, what are you doing? And I think, you know, no disregard to anybody who works in a brandless enterprise industry, but I think I was craving more for a brand element. And I think, you know, I endearingly remember those days at Under Armour where brand was at the forefront of every conversation. So with General Motors and having, like, you know, incredible brand, whether it's Cadillac, Chevrolet, you know, GMC, Buick, you just feel like it's not a brand which was formulated last couple of years. We were talking about 100 years plus the brand, some good, some probably not great. But you know, if you look at our product portfolio over the last sort of, you know, 10 years, I mean, there's a reason why GM's the number one largest sort of volume seller in the country right now for the last sort of almost consecutively last 10 years. And it's just endorsement from the customers around why the product is. And I think, since going back to the question you asked and the reason I shared this background, there's also something about tactical product. I could talk software, I could sell software, I could do whatever, but when you go and touch your own product, there's something just beautiful about it. And and everything connects back to who you are at the end of the day. Like, if it floats your boat for physical product design, then that's going to motivate you, because you're like, I'm more motivated to go and have my team sell this, right? Whether it's through digital, e-commerce, whatever it is. So I think it just, you know, with that and what's happening in the EV industry, where every car is now basically like a chip and a computer, right?
Right.
And all the concepts of software as a service, SaaS concepts of distributing value-added services over the air, all of that is brought to life. So when I think about Under Armour, Microsoft, you know, which was a, you know, primarily a SaaS and a PaaS industry, and then GM, it helps me, like, pull those threads together in terms of
I think that's fascinating, and kind of like, I almost want to go to the opposite of the question, because it seems like that's where the rest of the world is going. Commerce, service. It's almost like, to me, people are trying to treat service as a commodity. We're just going to give it to the robots. It's about getting the right answer. It's not about the personal touch. It's not about the feeling per se. And it's connected to commerce only to serve up the right link and to get you out of the queue. How it seems to me, even just from a role definition point of view, GM had a different vision for you coming in. And so I would love to hear about that interplay between commerce and service and like where people are getting it wrong, if you have sort of a counter thesis to that or.
Yeah. And thanks for keeping me on course for answering the question more precisely. So I kind of improvised a little bit, but yeah, just the starting point on services. And so for the audience benefit, when we are talking service, it's not just customer service. We're talking service as in,
yeah,
your car needs service. Right.
Parts, yeah.
And you need to be pulled into the service lane at the dealer to get your car fixed, right? And part of my team's role is, how do you digitize that experience? Hmm. How do I make sure when you pull into the dealership and you even schedule the appointment earlier on, one, you can do it easily. Second, you're clear, the dealer's clear on what you're coming in for. Third, you can drop your car without tons of pain, get your loaner vehicle, and then track your visit, pay for it. Like, these are opportunities, you know, not rocket space, but it's, you know, we don't exist.
Yeah.
So I think the reason why service and sales are connected and kind of part of my remit is we believe a lot of the sales journey actually start with when you pull into the dealership to get your car fixed. That's when you start thinking about your next vehicle. That's where you aspire, because you walk the shop floor and you're like, look at that escalator.
Mm, right.
Like, before I started working for GM, I was like, never would want to go and sit in a large vehicle. Right? Because you had this sort of urban mindset of like small, quick, you know, efficient. And now you're like, okay, there's no other word except for beautiful big cars, you know. Right. You're riding in there. So I think it's just the point around, how do you drive that sales experience aspiration? And the part of the second part of services, if you had a bad service experience, that's the last time you're ever going to consider buying that vehicle from that. Right.
Yeah, so you tell everybody about it too.
100%. Right. So it's managing both of that part and making sure we're driving that sales funnel and sales consideration. And then the second part tactically is like, there's also an opportunity of selling service plans. So if you've bought an EV and we can say, hey, we can give you a 3-year at your home service plan for X amount of dollars, then you're like, oh, I'm already buying it. It's part of my financial payments. If I have to spend $5-$10 to get my car fixed every time at my doorstep, hey, that's the cost of doing business in terms of reconciling the vehicle. So that's an e-commerce element of it. Similarly, I can have my vehicle at the service lane and I may realize, hey, the OnStar plan is defunct or it needs to be renewed. Mm. I can send you a push notification and get that activated, right? So we're throwing the trend, the journey. At the end of the day, it's not about like, I'm going to sell it or I'm going to service. Like, it's the same journey. So we've got the teams kind of taking from different angles and pulling out.
That's exciting. Well, and you talk about, going back to something you said earlier, you know, the brand is so important, and all of these aspects really are a representation of the brand and the brand experience. And it doesn't ever stop when you're in that customer journey, as you said, right? You have to look at that as that's another opportunity to win the customer, keep the customer, because they will buy another vehicle at some point, and that experience is going to likely factor into it, right?
100%. And I mean, it, you know, more so than ever, like, we know people who are loyal to brands ultimately drive more than half the purchases for that brand, right? And it's not just a GM phenomena. That's a phenomena across every product. Like, retention matters more than acquisition.
Right.
And every marketeer will endorse that.
Yeah, so kind of building on, we talked about teams and navigating complexity or unpredictability and how you keep people motivated. You talked about putting, I like to use the phrase, wins on the board, right? You want to show them the dividends of their execution. And when your team bridges things like IT, marketing, operation, dealer networks, how are you setting up or thinking about that collaboration so that you avoid silos, but you are tapping into the functional expertise that you have?
Yeah. You know, it's a question I could answer, but I mean, it's painful, right? It's painful, not just for us. It's painful.
Seems impossible.
It's a very painful.
Doesn't OKR don't OKR solve all those problems?
I know,
but,
right?
Right. I was like I said, like I wish you know you could just say, hey, it's like, oh, God, why can't we do it? But at the end of the day, this is where the rhythm of business of how you operate really matters, right? Like, if you have an OKR, which you know, however much we can hate the OKR, it's a good starting point. Right. Hey, are we tied to the hip on our what the outcome we're trying to drive as a cross-functional team?
Yeah.
But I think it comes down, at least in my opinion, I've seen, if you don't have the right sockets around how work gets done, and not just to review the work, because what happens is people come, show up into cross-functional team meetings, will generally give their opinion, sort of 80%, yeah, we're supportive, 20% haven't thought about this, and then go move on to their thing, right? Does that bring consistent collaboration? I don't think so, right? Because ultimately, when push comes to shove, the shove goes boom, and you really start to think, like, is this cross-functional team behind the decisions we made as a team? And you see clearly the alignment's not strong.
Yeah.
So I think part of it is like, how do we make them part of the work, not just part of the review?
Yeah, and I think about like where the projects go off the rails is, first of all, if you're in a cross-functional team, it's not usually not your primary team, right? It's like, it's an extra thing to your job. Yeah. And so sometimes that's becomes your first team, like if it's like a product manager and a developer type of role, where the PM considers the devs their team. But if you're in a marketing role, it's almost always like, oh, I'm going to be on this thing. And to me, where the rubber hits the road is like, are your bosses' incentives aligned or not?
Exactly.
And if your boss's incentives are not aligned, we talked about OKRs a little bit, which is obviously one way to do it, then they're just going to go back to their cube and work on something else until the next meeting.
Or it's like, when you have these teams that are so large, I found you have to keep them focused, because otherwise they'll just make an assumption of what they think their role or their day-to-day is supposed to be versus trying to keep that connective tissue. So it feels like communication really is so critical and important. Are there strategies that you have, Sid, on like, you know, the way you communicate, the way you... you know, articulate what the plans are and how you do try to keep everybody aligned?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard. and probably I'm not fantastic at it, but I would just say that some of the tactics which have seemed to work is, one, to your point, right? Like, if the incentives are not aligned, then you'll see the dysfunction kind of show up. But you know, there's always an occasion randomly where you see the stellar talent who's not motivated by what their boss told them to do.
Yeah.
Right? And I think that's just really keeps my trust in enterprise that not everybody's doing because their bosses are telling them. Like, some people actually believe there's the right things to do to enterprise forward. So my point one is, there's a glimmer of hope. There's enough good people who can break this sort of dysfunction we have. The second part is, it's time consuming, but when you ask about strategies which work, big meetings, communicating what we're trying to do and bring consensus, it just doesn't work. Right? People show up, they sort of
say
yes, say yes, but aren't they really saying yes? They don't even know what they said yes to. So I think it's investment, but you've got to pick up the phone. Not even email. Yeah. You've got to pick up the phone.
It's true.
You've got to build connection. You've got to sort of socialize. Yeah. You've got to also get some feedback and be open to feedback. But the idea is not that you're just giving the message and saying, I checked the box, I got this one.
Yeah.
But like, are you truly willing to adapt and change based on feedback? And I think if you have that mindset and the time, obviously you have to have the luxury of time a little bit. That's the only thing which I've seen truly kind of go to the grassroots and work. Big meeting stuff is fine. It's just at generates alignment.
And you made such a good point at the beginning. I'm going to keep coming back to it over and over, that execution drives morale. And I think part of the reason is that the new team that you formed for this task now is bought into each other because they've seen something that they produced together, which is kind of like the storming, forming, you know, part of the team dynamics that everyone speaks about. But picking the first task always seems like the hardest thing, because if you pick the wrong thing, it's going to take too long and maybe people lose patience. Like, how do you set the vision to get the team moving out of this planning focused mode into doing mode?
Yeah, it's again, you know, sometimes it comes down to individuals. Some individuals have a tendency to proactively move. Some are waiting to be kind of inspired to move, right? So part of it is individual, but that being aside, I think it ultimately comes down to how us as leaders, we can set a safe space to fail. And I know this is very played out, so please bear with me the idea of, you know, fail fast and failing be acceptable. But it truly is, like, if there's repercussions for, you know, making the bad move and there's history around it, everybody's going to be like, let me find the strategy. Let me define the strategy. Right. Let me define alignment. Let me talk to forward people. Make sure we're aligned.
Forever.
The monkey's not on my back, but then it's on our back. And I just want people to feel comfortable having monkey on their back. It's fine.
Yeah.
Right? No. Like, that's probably, it's on us. It's easier said than done, but I can ask my team. I don't know. Do I make them comfortable? I think that's what it comes down to. How do leaders set up sort of that safe psychological safety?
Yeah. And how do you feel about aligning around the C-suite? And you've got a very complex ecosystem. You know, we're talking about, you know, at the end of the day, the people who you are relying on to get things done. But it also starts at the top. And what are the things that you feel are important to make sure your C-suite is staying in sync, so that you don't have those fractures and cracks as, you know, different parts of the organization?
Yeah. So you know, I won't talk GM specifically because it's just a big company and massive sort of remit across the C-suite, right? But I would say generally, executive management is a very hard skill set for even senior leaders in the companies to have. And this is just my observation in the career. How we make sure that, again, it comes down to rhythm of business, that we establish sockets where you proactively are seeking feedback, right? And it's a double-edged sword.
Yeah.
Feedback is a lot more work because you got to go fix it and do things. But
but
I found, like, even C-suite leaders, when they know that they are engaged in active shaping of initiatives, they're a lot more lenient than when they are put into a situation of, don't know about this initiative, this team is coming in asking for permission. Either I say, like, okay, if you guys are aligned, I'm aligned, or I say, guys, what is exactly this? Like, doesn't make any sense. And I don't think we want either of those situations. We want a dialogue.
Right.
And the dialogue only happens when they're engaged, and you can't engage them once at a blue moon. So I think it's hard, it's industrious, it takes a lot of work. But people who have the fire to develop that skill set, I think, are most sort of prone to success in enterprise. And I make enterprise sound so, like, you know, junky and contrived. That's not the point. Like, matrixes and enterprise can be a competitive advantage. It's just, you have to approach it there, right?
Yeah, well, let's bust that myth, because there is the perception that when you're at these large companies, you know, Microsoft, GM, it's really hard to move and move fast. Can you give us some examples of where you feel like the size has helped you
scale faster or maybe be a bit more competitive than some early emergers?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, like, if you really think about how many vehicles we sell a day, right, that's captive audience.
Yeah.
Like, I don't have my teams to work hard to sell vehicles every day. Now they do support and aid a lot of the digitization and online sales that relates to how we sell vehicles. But at the end of the day, we have consumers who love our vehicles, and they will show up in dealerships and pick up our product with the product script. Now, the sales experience is terrible. Yes, we may a lot of lose people, mm-hmm. but even if you had an average sales experience, we would sell it, right? Like, that's mm-hmm. that's an advantage to have. I've worked with smaller companies, either in advisory board setting or board mm-hmm. setting, where we had 6 people show on the website.
Right.
Right?
Yeah. You don't have the advantage.
Yeah.
Like, I'm like, what am I doing here every day? There's 6 people on the website. So I think that advantage I never take for granted, because it's incredible. When I think about our parts business, accessories business, our services, you know, software services business, all of it is scattered around how many units of vehicles are sold. Mm-hmm. And if those are sold, we know we have the tailwinds to drive, you know, volume based on what we sell.
Yeah.
So I think that's very distinct. The second from just like how we work and how that can be a competitive advantage or disadvantage. Disadvantage piece is clear. All big companies, you know, complex to navigate. But the advantage is, I think there's a lot of, when companies as size of GM, as large as they are, and the volumes they're driven, it could be easily said then, hey, we don't need to change or, you know, this
right.
works. But positively, I found there's a just willingness to understand and learn, because automotive is such a precarious sort of industry. You could be a leader today and you can be a leader tomorrow, right?
Yeah.
So the idea and the appetite for change has to be really rooted into every sort of rants and files. And I just see that. I see that, like, I've never been shut off like bad idea.
Yeah. And it's so interesting as you move out from the enterprise and how the employees think about innovation to the dealers, there's a lot of parallels from your Microsoft background. You have the platform, and then you have your VAR, your value-added resellers and your integrators. There's this whole ecosystem of people that need to view what you're doing and the tools that you have as an advantage and not a detractor. And so if you have someone who is at the dealer, how do you address or have your teams think about, because if you're a sales rep on the floor, the person in front of you is paramount. It's not the tool on your desk. And so, and I think as a lot of like large enterprise distributors, manufacturers are digitizing, there's this perceived tension between the digital tools and the human relationships. Can you like unpack that a little bit, like as you think about it from a GM point of view?
Yeah, you know, I think you and I are like, you know, you can ask like, do we like self-service or do we like right. a human? And my answer would be, I like a human who's efficient.
Right.
Right? If a human has no background, no information.
Yeah, useless.
He or she could be like awesome, but it's a waste yep. of time.
Right. Yeah.
So I think that to me frames up the opportunity digital is trying to solve. It's not trying to just create self-service and replace all of that. But one is, where it's self-service and I don't need to call an advisor to change my plan in OnStar, I shouldn't be.
Yeah.
I should be doing online. If I want to upgrade and downgrade my plan, yeah, it's a great opportunity to upsell and you know, upsell you from an advisor. But no, I can change and do it online because I'd like to. But if I go into the dealership, mm-hmm. I want the salesperson not to restart the conversation from ground zero.
Right.
Sure. You want to hand off?
I just spend 15 minutes building and configuring an incredible piece of vehicle with the right options and packages online. You also potentially, I could put in my trade-in. I could also put in my lease paperwork. Can we just start there?
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I think that's really comes down to, at the end of the day, everything is omnichannel. And
right.
how do we make sure we really tread this journey based on the desirability and the need of the customer? Easier said than done.
Right.
All of us in this phone call have worked in capacity, many capacities in digital. complex, especially when you think about technology systems at OEM, which is GM.
Yeah.
Technology systems at the dealership, completely independent fiscal entity. How do you integrate that to create that seamless journey for the customer, right? So it's complex, and I think that's what that makes me show up every day, because I feel that opportunity could.
Yeah, those are fun problems to solve. I don't think you knew this. My dad sold cars for a while for GM. So he was on the green screens, though. Like, it was way old school. You know, this is probably 15 years ago. But yeah, I think that it sounds like, regardless of what you're doing at GM, it still centers on the customer and how to make that experience as seamless as possible. So that customer first mentality is what's driving the decision making and making sure that there's good connectivity. When you think about that strategy, and merchandising also plays a big role, right, in how you merchandise and that configuration. Can you tell us about the way you think through some of those decisions and how you put yourself in the customer's shoes? Sounds like you're shopping big cars now, but what are some other strategies you all use to make sure you're like watching the customer, listening and anticipating needs?
Yeah, and thanks for asking this, because this is like one of my passion areas, which is how do we make merchandise not so category centric, right? Like if you think about the term merchandising, it's so tethered to CPG and like more consumables or discretionary purchases and stuff like that. So when I first joined GM, like that was one of the journeys, like how do you introduce merchandising in an industry which is not typically kind of used in that sense, right? We've got suppliers, we've got manufacturers, we do bunch of parts and accessories, but no one merchandises anything. We're a wholesaler. Yeah. Wholesale stuff to dealers to sell.
Right.
So when you start to run direct to consumer or direct to consumer like businesses, now the idea of product presentation is real.
Yeah.
And probably easier to get on the parts and accessory size and parts, like merchandising a part. I don't really need to merchandise a part. What I need to do is to be accurate around the product descriptions.
Sure.
I need to be accurate around what it fits, what it doesn't fit, right? And I think this idea around accuracy and specificity, how do you connect that with the concept of merchandising is important, because the world thinks of merchandising as a creative product presentation strategy. Mm-hmm. But in case of parts, it's around all around depth of specification. So I think, how do we take every category, and then in those two vehicles is all about romancing the vehicle, but also telling you technically how the vehicle is sound.
Yeah.
So taking just this, everything I learned from my apparel days, and saying, how do we build a true expertise in the company around merchandising across very disparate categories, which have never understood what merchandising is, has been a journey. But I would say, like, I've an incredible team. You know, they've picked on this passion and done a really incredible job on this one.
That's
great. Yeah, go ahead.
I wanted to pull a thread in your answer that talked about priorities, you know, particularly with around parts. You talked about accuracy and description is part of those goals. And I was thinking about enterprise. The biggest risk at any software development, but enterprise in particular, is not that you can't build the thing, but that you're building the wrong freaking thing. And so the question is, like, even just that simple statement, like, our number one goal is accuracy and product description. Like, where did that come from, and how do you get that to the teams that are working on the product in a consistent way, and how do you ensure that's right? I mean, we were talking with Stephen Cope from Astrak in the last couple of weeks, and he told us the American buyer of parts was quite different than the UK buyer of parts. And so even across cultural boundaries, you could have different priorities. So talk a little bit about that customer inside view and how do the digital teams start from there?
And we may have found ourselves there, but and the greatest learner is when you see tons of returns, right? And We started e-commerce journey only like 7-8 years back. So it wasn't a volume business, and I'm not talking about our terms being like crazy, but you know, my point is those kind of events really articulate clearly what the customer need is and where you're sort of mismatching to, right? The thing with parks and things like that, there's also really good reference points in the industry, like not necessarily OEM websites, but there's some really strong parks websites which have been around for a long time. So I think there's enough reference to say, what's the right thing to do here? Like, parks is not a discovery-based e-commerce experience. It's a search-based e-commerce experience.
Yeah.
Like, you've got a Silverado, what do you care about browsing some parts for some other vehicle, right?
Right. It's very functional, right?
It's like, I got 500 today. What part can I buy? No.
Yeah.
Like, so it's like you got to overdrive your search. Yeah. You've got to overdrive your qualification.
Right.
I could still understand that, hey, this is the right part for my vehicle. But there's all this sense of doubt, and you want to validate that. So how do you take away that doubt through like multiple validations, like this indeed is your thing, checkbox, yes, it fits your vehicle, into the exploded diagram, which shows where it's that's right. Like there's a lot of interesting
all those steps,
which again, we've learned our ways, through it, and we've also been inspired by some good examples. But I also, it's not a silver bullet to finding that, Greg, but you know, Naomi, that's kind of the job, right?
Yeah.
Every day, and you sort of figure out like what can you do better.
Well, you mentioned some other industries or other examples of companies that have inspired you on the parts journey. Are there other industries or companies you look to as you think about merchandising and bringing that strategy into GM? Is who's doing it really well from your perspective that you felt like, hey, this is the North Star we want to drive to?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I would say it depends on the category, right? Like if you're talking about vehicles, we would look at high ticket purchases and see like, what are they doing? And obviously Apple's of the world do a great job. Now it may be a little bit too sort of illustrative and too sort of detailed, but I think that's sort of an interesting reference point of like, especially with the multiple steps purchase journey, like vehicles.
Yeah.
You know, at one point I might be romancing it with lifestyle. At one point I might be telling you technical specs as you go closer into the purchase journey. At the third point, I might be giving you the subtle differences between trims.
Yeah.
At the fourth time, I might make it say like, hey, it's really easy to buy and your payments are only like $400 a year, month. So I think it's interesting also like the consideration set is different around what's the decision, purchase decision. But for commodity stuff, I think there's a lot of good e-commerce examples, as you guys know, in the apparel business, especially happening when I would think about like other functional areas, like you look at B2B sites like Grainger and a lot of the other stuff. You know, not saying we're doing B2B necessarily, but the way they've managed to sort of just be clear and direct and be allowed to order study functional categories, I think that's a different set of competitive examples you always inspire by.
No, that's great. And it, like you said, you're navigating a lot of different things. Like some customers might be aspirational. Some customers, if you're like me, I just need a sunroof. And so show me the things that have the coolest sunroof because that's my number one feature I'm shopping. So you have to be able to manage through those dynamics.
Yeah, or get somebody like who wants a spoiler for their race car.
And, yeah.
You know, that is a very, I would say, brand-driven, adrenaline-driven purchase journey, which has no functional aspects, right? Like, that person is not looking at, like, what's my wind drag or anything. Like, they're just looking at the coolest spoiler. And then there's probably a cultural context to it, is how do you bring that cultural context forward around this spoiler versus that spoiler? Like, are we doing that? We're not doing it, but I think my point of bringing that is, I think that we've got to go not just at the category level, you got to go at the department, sub-department level and really say, what's the context which drives this kind of purchase decision and how do we create the right content to support it?
Yeah.
So we haven't asked the AI question, Rick.
I know. I was waiting for which...
We haven't asked it. So do you want to ask the AI question?
Yeah, I was waiting for which one of us was going to get there first. So AI is obviously changing like every minute, it feels like now. And the team, I'm sure, always has this choice. Do we embrace the new thing, or do we go with sort of the tried and true? How much do we, is this going to confuse the user? Is this going to enhance the experience? Like, can you, maybe we'll just start with how you think about experimenting with AI in your within your framework of execution drive results, not planning drives results.
Yeah, AI, I mean, as you guys get, you know, overwhelmed with sort of the possibilities question, the one good news with, you know, the space I have around e-commerce and service, they're a little bit more precise in terms of opportunities, at least the first round of opportunities, I'm saying, right? Whether it's AI in refining product prescriptions, AI in product recommendations, AI-based search, AI in trying to understanding like return mitigation and return prospecting. Right. Or there's AI in terms of which way, how should I bring it from the product and sell it. In the service solution space, I've seen AI in terms of making sure we go into proactive alert management. There's AI in terms of telling the customer, like, what's the chance of breaking some part down, right? So you're seeing very well proven and understood concepts, but I haven't found a lot of vendors, and I'm probably gonna get a lot of emails.
Just wait.
Which typically happens.
Your LinkedIn's about to blow up. I see in your future. Yeah.
So that's fine. I welcome any insight. But again, it comes down to like, can you do it? Sure, everybody can do it, right? And that was my great example. Like Vin said, there are two AI companies who would say, like, my AI is better than your AI. And I'm like, okay. But how do I know? Ultimately, the results will say, oh, then run a pilot.
Yeah.
Running a pilot is not cheap. Running a pilot takes tons of mind share from us. So I think it just comes down to, we need some more proven models around what works, have a history of success, and then we can engage. So that's kind of really been the challenge, is like finding proven, established thing. And then you're like, you got to give people chance. Like, sure, but bigger companies, it just becomes harder because you're like trying to navigate and, you know, so that's where we are.
Yeah, I feel that. It feels like, though, every day somebody's like, well, why can't AI solve that? Right. You have a complex problem. It's like, but why can't AI solve that? So, yeah, we have to tone down those expectations a little bit and manage through it. It is not the silver bullet, I think, yet. Everyone hopes it will be, but we'll see. So you do see so many different trends in e-commerce and probably on the forefront of a lot of trends. What's a sleeper trend, something that you think people is maybe not on the radar, but by 2030, you know, you feel like it's going to be big. Is there something you're watching?
It probably will happen sooner than later, but I think, you know, we're seeing a lot of content creation, right? I mean, you guys are seeing, your LinkedIn feed is full of it. It's getting tiring, honestly. Like, I've seen enough of like memes, this, that. So like, but I'm hopeful when I think about just, how do I experience a product in the digital space?
Yeah.
Yeah, 3D spins and all have been around, but like, how much work were they taking? Like, that person was like setting up their pop-up studio for like 3 days and taking 200 shots. And oh, by the way, the spec of the product changed.
Right.
Now what? Now he's gonna say.
We do.
So I'm really hoping for this like, engine, AI-based product, like product content creation engine, which can really give customers a little bit more deeper insight, because you know, our e-commerce sales would be double if people could understand product better. Right. I mean, it's not just in our industry, like it's probably in every e-commerce aspect. It ultimately comes down to, are you convinced it's the right product? And second, can you understand it and appreciate
it? What about voice? Is there something you feel like, we talk about merchandising and the shopping experience, and it is still point-click discovery. Do you feel like there's a role in voice and commerce, especially in what you're doing?
Yeah, whether it's voice or whether it's type, but this idea of assisted shopping, I think it's been explored for a while, but I think we're probably better suited to do it than we've been in the last 20 years, right? Especially when I think about vehicles, right? Like, complex category? How do I think about simplifying my choices? How do I understand trims better? And then there's also obviously the management side of it. Is like, how can I manage the complexity and the ownership experience?
Yeah.
So there's tons there, and I think it's only a matter of time, like how you sort of figure out, you know, what to do there. So I think voice particularly like has a time and place. We've all experienced it, sitting in bed and can't really voice right now, right? And it, so yeah. I think so that input mechanism has its own sort of evaluation, but I put that sort of necessarily different as like natural language and how search and shop using natural language and assisted shopping.
Got it. And this has been such a great conversation. Would love to wrap with like some bits of your wisdom. If you're a leader, we talked a lot to leaders, and there are a lot of people in the audience who are early to mid-career that are, at the end of the day, they have to be in their job thinking about how to improve the experience of their customers. Like, what's your number one piece of advice to those out there that are kind of in that kind of role?
Yeah, find your own inspiration and go figure it out how you do that as part of your job, right? Now, easier said than done, right? There's a leader who tells me like, find inspiration. No, I don't mean it, but it doesn't have to be like, hey, it's your complete personal passion, but here's a reason why you took a certain job. Mm-hmm. One out of the nine things you do has to be something which inspires you. And if it isn't, it's not the right job for you.
Right.
And
that's one out of nine is a pretty low bar.
That's a really low bar. I get it. I get where you're going.
If somebody tells me like it's like seven, I'm like, good for you, right? But yeah. I think jobs like job, but find the one, two, three out of nine, and I think that's enough, right? That's enough to keep your sort of focus and keep your like personal energy going, because if you don't find yourself in the work you do, it's gonna be tough. So I think that's all I would say. And I know some people are like, no, it's a job, I need the money. If you're young, probably even more so, right? And I understand all of that, but like, try it. Like, I mean, if you're passionate, that means you're talented. And generally speaking, those two things are connected.
No, that's so great. And it's what keeps you going, right? We've all seen those things of you spend all of this amount of time at work, more time than you've sometimes been with your family and your friends. And so you got to find the joy in it.
100%.
Well, your career is so impressive, and it's been just truly amazing to talk to you. And I feel like we've barely scratched the surface of tapping into your knowledge. But it's been wonderful, and I really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Jess. Thank you, Rick.
Thank you. I appreciate it, Sid.
Good to chat with you guys. And, you know, hopefully this gives the audience something to think about. And, you know, I'm looking forward to when it gets sort of published.
Absolutely.
Awesome. Well, I appreciate you coming by. Thanks so much.
Yeah. Thank you.
All right, I'm back. Kaplan's corner, and Kaplan is still held hostage. This is my first pre-record, and I look at this like around me. I feel like I'm in hallowed ground here, the RMW Global Headquarters studio. I've reached, I feel like almost like the pinnacle of a long and storied career, but this is it. So why am I here today? Well, I'm back. I'm back because we're still held hostage. Very confusing times we're in, but here's what I'll have to say. China and the US met in London. And while there's a lot of talk about rare earth minerals and the Geneva Truce, I heard is what Lutnick may have said, right? That's what we sort of have reached. And Trump is talking about opening trade in China to the US. There's still a ton of confusion, and we're still held hostage. And, you know, Howard Lutnick is saying that the China tariffs will remain 55%. That is a very, very steep number. The 301 tariffs largely remain in effect, and it's, you know, it's affecting a lot of people. So what I'd say, I guess, today in looking at the landscape is this might be it. And, you know, we see certainly on the SMB side, a lot of margin pressure to businesses. We see people sort of trying to figure out on the supply side a little bit of defraying costs, passing some onto the retail pricing, but largely impacting their margins. So, you know, no matter what sector or business you're in, you're feeling some level of pressure. I think that obviously for higher price points, larger AOV businesses, they're a little bit easier to absorb. But for those that are sort of almost like the traditional small business traders, buy in China, sell in the US, buy in China, sell in the US, like the day of reckoning is here and it doesn't seem to be going away. So I guess what I'd say is we're in uncertain times still. All that we've talked about vis-a-vis people, model evolution, inventory management is critical. I think trying to find ways to diversify your revenue, critical. Manage your inventory to not have to discount come 12/26, critical. And so unfortunately, we're in this moment where markets are up, a lot of economic indicators are good, but for us in this sector, we're not seeing consumers buying. It's really strange, and they're being far more selective about what it is that they're investing in. And so as a result, what I'd say is like, I'll continue to come back. We'll continue to talk about things as they unfold, but 8 or 10 or 12 weeks later, I can't even remember at this point, we're still here. We're still held hostage and there's really no sign of letting up. So my parting words are manage your inventories, folks, because you're better off having too little than having too much in these strange and trying times. That, my friends, is today's Kaplan's Corner.